Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm really excited to have with me today, all the way from Michigan, Dr. Chad Brummett, who is an associate professor of anesthesiology. He's also the director of clinical research in the Department of Anesthesiology, and he's the co-director of the Michigan Opioid Prescribing Engagement Network, which is also known as OPEN. And so the background here is that Chad came and gave a fascinating and really, really great grand rounds here at Hopkins about the opioid crisis and some of the really interesting stuff that they're doing, that his group is doing there in Michigan to try to address this. Listeners will know that I had Shravani Durbakala on the show a couple of months ago to talk about kind of some overview of the opiate crisis, and so I thought this would be a really nice way to follow that up with some specifics about what people can do if they're interested, since Chad and his group are really doing some great stuff. So let's jump in. Chad, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I guess I should say that you have a connection to Hopkins. You did your pain fellowship here some time ago. Is that right?
About a decade ago. That's correct.
Okay. Well, it was great to have you back to give grand rounds, and certainly happy to have you on the show. So let's just start with just a little bit of review and overview. When we say the opioid crisis or the opioid epidemic, what are we talking about?
Sure. I mean, I think that everybody's aware, at least vaguely, that there is a problem in the U.S. This is a true epidemic. We're losing currently about 115 people per day to opioid-related overdose. And I think what's striking about that is when I started lecturing 2 years ago, I would have said 78 deaths per day. And last year, I would have said 91 deaths per day. And even the 115 deaths per day, that data is from 2016. So we're not even reflecting today here in 2018, which is probably more in the 130 to 150 deaths per day range. And wow. And granted, I think we are seeing more lay press around this, the increase in street fentanyl. Mm-hmm. So not necessarily fentanyl diverted from operating rooms, but fentanyl made in homes by drug dealers, and heroin because of the sort of the downstream effects of opioid use disorder, where people turn to heroin because it's cheaper and more available. But really, in the end, I think it's important to note that this most of our patients who or most of our people who start on heroin begin with prescription opiates that are licit prescriptions. Granted, that may not have been their prescription, but these are licit prescriptions. So we have people dying every day, and this sharp spike in mortality is certainly from more potent drugs being available like heroin and fentanyl, but there's still a root cause here, which is prescription opiates.
Right. So it's not like these people, or at least a large number of them, they're not going out and saying, gee, I've never done anything like this before, but give me some fentanyl. They're starting off with a prescription, whether it's theirs or someone else's, of opiate pain medicines, usually pills, right? And then they end up getting addicted and go down the road that ends them up at a fentanyl or carfentanyl or some kind of overdose that can kill them.
That's correct. And especially with our teens and adolescents, that's true. We are seeing, as heroin becomes more ubiquitous, it won't surprise me if in 5 years we start to say more people have first time starts with heroin. But today, it's primarily through prescription opiates. And that increase in heroin is from the increase in opioid use disorder that starts with prescription opiates.
Okay. And just, I guess, another basic question. When we say opiate use disorder, are we talking about essentially what people think of when they think of being addicted, or is there more to it than that?
No, that's correct. This is opioid addiction, but I think as the psychiatrist and addictionologist would term it, opioid use disorder. So it's broader, and there are new criteria that have been put out in the DSM-5. I can't sort of cite them off the top of my head because I am not an addiction medicine specialist.
Sure.
But there are certainly other factors that go into the more granular diagnosis. But that diagnosis of addiction is also termed opioid use disorder.
Okay, great. Thanks for clarifying that. So most of our listeners are involved. They're all involved in healthcare, as far as I know. Certainly most are physicians of some kind or another, but we have other providers, CRNAs and nurses. But in general, what role do providers, and I guess especially physicians, play in perpetuating this problem?
Well, I think we're critical. I think when I speak to doctors and nurses and providers around the country, I always point out the fact that I think I have been part of the opioid epidemic. I overprescribed during, my career, and I didn't really appreciate that I was contributing. We had this misconception, in part due to bad marketing and in part due to some aggressive policy, that led to this idea that opioids weren't addictive if you had real pain. I mean, we certainly were all taught that if you're in real pain or if you're just using it for acute pain, you can't become addicted. And that's just not true. And so we overprescribed. And I think especially when we think about what we're addressing in acute care, or in particular in surgical and dental care, we haven't really appreciated our role in that when we overprescribe to people, we lead them potentially down this path of new dependence or addiction. And we also contribute to the risk for that person's family or their community through unused pills. So while there's lots of fingers to point, and we could probably spend a whole hour just talking about how we got here.
Sure.
And we shouldn't lose those lessons because we don't want to do this again. I'm an action person. I'm a let's do something about this person.
Yeah.
And I believe that we really have to be careful about spending too much time in our conversations about this problem pointing fingers, because really in the end, every physician and every provider, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, should just simply look in the mirror and ask, well, what have I done to get us here? And what am I going to do to make things better?
Yeah, absolutely. And so the concept of overprescribing, I think, is really interesting, right? How does one know what the appropriate amount to prescribe is? Presumably, it's somewhere between zero and what we're doing now. So how do we know?
Well, today, for many conditions, we don't, but our group is certainly working to close that gap.
Mm-hmm.
There have been other groups working sort of step for step. The Dartmouth group, Doctors Hill and Barth, have done some really nice work and have also published in parallel with our group, demonstrating, I think, that the Hill article published in Annals of Surgery was one of the first articles to kind of come out and sort of, at least in a big splash, suggest that about 70% of the pills we prescribe go unused after surgery. And that's a striking number. So I'll project that out for our state, just the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. If you say that we know there's 1.8 million surgeries per year in the state of Michigan, we also see an incredibly consistent pill number of the equivalent of about 45 pills of 5 milligram hydrocodone. There's something about that 45 pill average that just holds strikingly clear all the way, whether you're talking about minor surgeries or major surgeries, 45 pills. So you could suggest there's 33 pills on extra per patient. And if you think about just those that are likely opioid naive, that could be 62 million pills in the state of Michigan for surgery alone.
Wow.
And that's from 1 year. That doesn't account for dentistry, doesn't account for overprescribing in emergency medicine or primary care, just surgery for 1 year alone. Well, now I go at a national level. There's 50 million surgeries done per year.
Right.
Right? There's 100 million procedures. So there's sadly some people that will get opioids after a colonoscopy or a cardiac catheterization. Not even accounting those, there's 50 million surgeries done per year, most of whom will get an opioid, most of whom will have an overprescription. And this is just absolutely pushing us down this path of just vast, vast overprescribing. And so, is it a billion pills in excess per year from surgery alone? I think it could be. I think it could be around a billion pills prescribes in excess in the U.S. each year. Now, I think we can trim that number pretty quickly, but how do we know? Because that's a harder question. Mm-hmm. Well, we've done quality improvement projects, as has the Dartmouth Group, and you're seeing other groups out there doing similar stuff, which is literally just simple stuff. This is not hardcore science, but calling patients and asking them how many pills they used. And sadly, most of them can answer the question because they can say, hold on a second, I'll go to my medicine cabinet and look. So they go to their unlocked medicine cabinet, they open it up a year ago and they say, from a surgery a year ago, and say, well, I've still got 20 pills left and I was given 25 or whatever it is, right?
Right, right.
And that's sadly how we are able to do some of this work today because they haven't disposed of those medications.
Right.
And I think it's important. We have actually then taken next steps to say, well, what's a better way to do this? So we've leveraged a really unique platform in the state of Michigan. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan has been funding surgical collaboratives around our state. And there's other collaborative structures that are beyond surgery, but there's about a half dozen collaboratives that actually come together about three times a year and talk about quality. And this is basically every major hospital in the system in our state. And they had a patient reported outcome, or at least a nurse extracted data outcome measure already in place. And what we did was effectively superimpose an opioid follow up to ask people how much they used. And we've started to use this now to inform prescribing recs. And so we put out the first sort of data driven prescribing recs in October. That can be found. There's a link from our website, which is michigan-open.org. But we put out these prescribing recs, and we've certainly received feedback. This is still too high, or I would never prescribe that much. And I will just completely agree with anybody who feels like our recs are still too high,
right?
Because we believe that the actual true number is lower. We also believe that as we prescribe less, people will take less, and we can talk more about that in a minute, why we believe that, because I think it's fascinating and really important to understand. Mm-hmm. But what we know today is those prescribing recs that we put out, there's a few things to take away. One is that they were data-driven. They were based on real prescribing and not just from a single academic medical center. Number two, they actually represent a big decrease in prescribing. So if you take Lap-Coli, for example, it's about a five-fold decrease in what people are actually prescribing in the U.S. today. And then even more so, it's at least a 50% reduction from some of those more major surgeries where some people were getting 90 or 100 pills on average in a month's period.
Right.
And I think the important piece of this, in this culture of, or in this time where everybody's feeling this push for policy of five-day limits, seven-day limits, whatever those are, a seven-day limit could be interpreted as two pills every 4 hours as needed for pain, which could be 84 pills. Well, I think our highest recommended number for a major abdominal surgical condition was 45 pills, which I still think is too high. But the point is that it's procedure specific, it's based on real data, and it's better than simply a blunt 7-day policy.
Right. Now, so for example, the Lap-Coli you mentioned, what's the recommended number of pills for a Lap-Coli?
So right now we've put down 15. We were prescribing on average 50. We put down 15, and I will admit that was very early and conservative. Interestingly, in a paper published by our group, first authors Ryan Howard, we actually implemented that. And what's interesting is that the median use decreased. So people who got less pills actually took less pills. And as you're aware, because you've seen the talk, this is a social psychology construct called anchoring and adjustment. When we give people more, they take more. This is mainly from food literature. So your bigger plate of food leads to more consumption.
Right.
Well, we're doing the same thing. And Brian Bateman from the Brigham published a really nice paper in the cesarean section, observational, but basically putting women into sort of low, medium, and high numbers of pills after cesarean section, and showed that women who got higher numbers of pills used more, but without any improvement in satisfaction, pain, or refill rate. And we found the same thing. Reducing didn't change that refill rate. And think about that. It's such a vulnerable time after having had a baby, sleep deprivation, postpartum depression, and now we're giving women, you know, 45, 70 pills after cesarean section,
right,
where many of them are using a handful at most.
Right. Yeah, and then they're sitting around in the medicine cabinet, as you said. So And, you know, I think it's really key because some people may think, oh, well, you know, if you give them less, they're going to use less because they're afraid of running out. But that's not true because, as you just said, they're not having any increase in pain scores when they get less pills, and they're not calling for refills at any higher rate. Is that right?
That's correct. So we actually found both in our Lap Coley project, we found that that the women who when we went from 50 pills on average to 15, the refill rate, while not significant, was actually a little lower. It went from a 4% refill rate to a 3% refill rate. And the cohort was too small to see that difference, but it probably is a significant difference and potentially could project out. But again, the same thing that Brian Bateman found in women with cesarean section, you know, the women who got lower numbers of pills didn't call for refills more often. And I think it's an important piece because I certainly appreciate the surgeon's concern about that potential to burden their clinic. And we know, we have some unpublished data from our group suggesting that the physician's assistants in the mid-levels actually prescribe more on average,
right?
Because they're, I think, probably appropriately concerned about that burden of refill.
Right.
And so, so I think these are important concepts. We also have another article published in Annals of Surgery last year, where we used a national payer data set and found no association between the number of pills prescribed and the likelihood of refill in a mixed surgical kit. So whether you lumped everybody together, adjusted, unadjusted, it didn't really matter. Whether you looked at six pills or more than 60 in a cohort of patients having both major and minor general surgical conditions, there was no association between the number of pills prescribed and the likelihood of refill. People tended to call for refill about 7% of this time.
Right.
But I think you would agree, what happens and what's a natural sort of human reaction is you have that one really challenging patient where it's Saturday evening and now they're calling for a refill and they've gone through 60 pills and then everybody starts to get 60 or 90 pills, even though many are going to use a handful at most.
Right.
But I'll just make sure they don't run out because I can't call them in anymore. So we have this hydrocodone limit. They're moving it to a schedule two, no longer able to phone it in. And so is that also potentially leading to some overprescribing? And we, again, have data suggest that it is.
Right. So, yeah, it's interesting, right? So basically providers, either they don't want the patient to be in pain and they mistakenly think they need this huge number of pills to treat their pain, or they're afraid of getting bothered at night or whatever to write refills or some combination of the two. But obviously, as your research and others has shown, we know that the data would suggest that this is not the case, that the refill rate isn't higher and that the pain isn't worse. So I know you've worked a fair amount on some education projects to try to take this data and get it across to the people doing the prescribing. So how have you done that?
Yeah, so, you know, some of it's been at a smaller local level, mm-hmm. Where we have simply just the Lap Coley project. Again, this is Brian Howard's JAMA surgery paper. You know, we just did a voiced over PowerPoint for this one condition and had surgery residents watch the video. And then we didn't really mandate anything. There was no forced number in the electronic medical record, but it basically had this incredible effect of reducing prescribing on average from 50 pills to 15 with a very narrow standard deviation. Mm-hmm. And we've reached some important marks. I know your residency role, so you'll appreciate that when we went past July and prescribing stayed low, I'll make the bold proclamation that we have forever changed laparoscopic cholecystectomy prescribing at the University of Michigan. Right. We went past to July.
Right.
It will now be forever and ever this way. My only hope is that because I believe the true number is lower, that we can go again lower. But I don't think we'll go back to 50.
Yeah.
Right? So I think we've reached a really interesting threshold. What was also cool, and again, these are data that are sort of circulating in our group and are getting closer, was the spillover effect that we didn't say anything about what to do with some other surgical conditions, but the residents, for whatever reason, applied the same logic and dropped prescribing in for other conditions that we went and looked at. And again, without any, at least electronic medical record appreciation of, or, or, evidence of adverse effect. No increase in refills, no ER visits. It wasn't as though this reduction in prescribing led to bad outcomes. But now they had a number. The number was for lap choline, and they applied it to lap appy and lap bariatric surgery and thyroid surgery. And said, oh, you know, that's kind of interesting. You give people a little bit of information, but I guess it shouldn't be that surprising if you think about it. Where did the 45 come from? Right. Where does that number come from? Right. It's an arbitrary number. We've given them now something that's not arbitrary.
Right. I find this so fantastic. So basically you did a one-time voiceover PowerPoint. You targeted residents because, as you said, it's the residents or the mid-level providers like physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners who are doing the prescribing, right? The attending surgeon at an academic center is not the one filling out the prescription. So you targeted right. the people actually doing it. You did a one-time voiceover PowerPoint, and not only did those residents reduce their prescribing for that condition, they passed it on to the new interns when they came, and yep. it fed over into other conditions without any additional education.
Absolutely. So I think there will I think we are specialized in medicine today, very specialized, and there is still a need. And we have broad work happening in knee and hip arthroplasty. We've got some early work in spine surgery. We've got foot and ankle. We're doing broader work in this space, and we know for sure that other groups have outside of our institution, as well as the Dartmouth group, who, as I said, well, I'll give a lot of credit to, they were also right there with us right from the very beginning without us really knowing, kind of doing very, very similar work, actually strikingly similar work. There'll be lots of sort of Me Too work after this, and we're great with it. We don't feel or need to own this. In fact, the Me Too work we think can be really, really powerful. And now what we're also excited about is sort of spreading that work into dentistry. And we just recently launched some similar work in dentistry, which I think, again, could be powerful. But I just totally agree. It's beautifully simple. This is not certainly the hardcore science that I think I started in. And yet I look at it and say, we've made really meaningful change. And now we spread that work across our state. So as we said, we put the prescribing recs across our state, and we are pushing those recs at a state level. And we have other groups interested in those recs outside of our state. We're certainly hoping that other major institutions were in early talks with other institutions just to sign on to our recs, because we don't really feel like we need to own these. We want engagement. If every institution out there has to go through what we went through to get recommendations, then we're not really helping the health of our country. We really want people to contribute where they have data, advise in places where they think we may have made a mistake or maybe missed. But most importantly, just get buy-in to have more groups around the country use this. There's certainly national societies out there that are interested in this, and we're happy to partner with national societies. At the same time, for us, this is not a political issue. It's not one that anyone needs to own, and we just want to move bigger and faster and make change today.
Yeah, that's great. Now, are your prescribing guidelines on your website?
Yeah, there's a link from the website. So I think it just is another sign of how we're really, really trying not to sort of own this or brand this. We made a new website that you can find from the michigan-open.org, but we made a third website called Opioid Prescribing Info. And the reason for that is, again, trying to get engagement from other groups with the hope that other groups will help populate that. And we have some collaborators at UNC, Chapel Hill, in South Carolina and elsewhere that will hopefully be contributing to these recs as we go forward. And we hope, as I said, when my time out at Johns Hopkins, I hope we can get, Hopkins to even sign onto these recs.
Absolutely. Tell me one more time what that other website is.
Opioid Prescribing .info.
Prescribing.info. Okay, so we'll put both that and the Michigan Open website on the show notes here. But that's great that you guys are doing that and have them available. I'm sure people will want to check them out. So you mentioned that people have a huge number of pills obviously left over because they're getting way over prescribed. They're sticking them in their medicine cabinets. And then one thing that you've done that I remember you talked about when you were here is to organize some pill drives to try to get people to clean out their medicine cabinets, obviously, so that we don't have kids or anyone else getting access to those medications and then potentially getting addicted to opioids. And so tell me a little about that. How do those work, and how have you organized those?
Yeah, so I was at an Azure meeting about 4 years ago, and Joe Ranazizi, who was formerly with the DEA, gave a talk, and I was just really inspired to do something. I run a large research team, and this even predates the Michigan Open Group, and we have a guiding principle of service to our community, and we were doing some really excellent community service work as a way to grow and give back, but we weren't really doing anything about pain or opioids, and I just saw this as an opportunity to do something bigger. So we held a single drive in Ann Arbor together with our police department, and we got 40 pounds of pills in a four-hour period, and I was just ecstatic. I thought that was incredible, but our drives kept getting bigger and bigger and started going to the point where we were getting 200 and 300 pounds in a four-hour period just in Ann Arbor. And with the new Michigan Open platform and this sort of statewide opportunity, we were able to take a next step, which is to engage hospitals in another state. And so in September of last year, we had about 8 sites around our state, including the Upper Peninsula. For those that know their Michigan geography, they'll know about our UP that's been decimated by the opioid epidemic. We got together for 1 4-hour period. We got about 900 pounds of pills together in 8 cities. And wow. And really, I think the most important thing we did, just to be very clear, is we created community awareness of the ill effects of leaving unused pills in your medicine cabinet. And that to me is the most important thing. We get excited about pounds of pills, but as I said, with potentially 1 billion pills in excess from surgery alone each year, we know for sure we didn't necessarily change things in a way that's going to revolutionize our overdose rates. But hopefully we got people aware through just our advertising, even if they couldn't make the event. And we've actually made a website for our state, and the DEA has a website, but basically a website for our state for people to think about everyday disposal options. And we're even working towards some more in-home disposal options. There are some activated charcoal bags that allow for in-home disposal. And we've done a trial this summer that we're just wrapping up to look at that as an option to make it really easy for people to dispose of their medications, because currently it's too hard. We are now positioning for our spring drive, which happens here in a couple months. And right now it looks like we're going to have about 20 to 25 cities around our state, really starting to fill in the state. And we're in the process of ideally we're pitching a national drive through a new grant mechanism. And so we really believe that we can do this. And just to try to make it easier, I'll put this out to anybody who's inspired by this work, because this is really awesome community engagement. We've actually made a toolkit on our website, on the Michigan Open website, where it gives you that we've got a video in there just sort of describing what we do or why we did it. We have an executive summary that describes what you need to do. And then we have a more detailed toolkit of all the little things, because I have a terrific admin who sort of first championed this with me, and she really did a lot of the work on this. But she literally just wrote down all the things that she thinks about: the tents, the tables, the duct tape, the boxes, mm-hmm. all those things where we want to make sure that we make it as easy as possible. And then our mock budget, like what we pay for in a budget, in a spreadsheet, all there just to help people get started. And this is how we create engagement in our communities. So we will hold weekly phone calls as the event leads up for people to call in, ask questions, and just keep everybody on track. By this point, you should be here. By this point, you should be here. And most of these things are run by someone in the hospital, or it could even be someone in the community. That's the thing. It doesn't have to be a hospital-based activity. And this is how we think we can expand this. And so certainly if there's any groups out there that are interested outside of our state in doing this, and we've had other groups express interest, they can feel free to tag on and reach out, and we will help make it happen no matter where you are.
That's right.
And I really believe that we can really spread this, because again, it's about creating awareness and just increasing engagement.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I'm so glad you have that on the website. We'll definitely direct folks to that as well. So what do people do if they, let's say someone out there is listening, they think, oh yeah, I had that Lap-Coli 8 years ago and I got that Vicodin and I'm sitting in my medicine cabinet. You said it's not easy to dispose of at home. I assume people shouldn't just dump them in the toilet and flush. How do you recommend that people get rid of them in the absence of an ongoing drive at that time that's actively collecting them?
So this is a debatable topic. Unfortunately, the FDA currently says you can mix them with a you know, something like kitty litter or dog waste and put it in the garbage. I personally recommend against that. They also recommend flushing down the toilet in the event that you can't. I did get a tweet back from the FDA recently, which where I kind of went back and said, hey, but you know, think about the environmental implications of flushing these down the toilet. Right. And I've had environmentalists who actually I just had an attorney who's involved in water treatment, and he said, please don't flush these down the toilet. Once they're in the water, we can't get them out. Right? Yeah. It's not like they can just throw a net in there and pull them out. Right? They're now dissolved. They're in the water, and we know for sure for many years. There's streams in the state of Washington with detectable levels of antidepressants, right? So let's not do this for opioids. And so safe disposal options are ideal. There are communities all over the country and areas all over the country where you can safely dispose of them. In Michigan, we've made the map, but the DEA has a website. My only caution in that is that before people go out and just drive over to that pharmacy or that police station, because most of them, just to be clear, will be police stations or sheriff's office. And that's a challenge too, where many people don't feel comfortable taking their medications back to police. And I understand that. There are many pharmacies that are DEA registered that don't know they're DEA registered. And we found this in our state. They've done the registration process, but they haven't developed a process for disposing those medications. And a process is needed, right, to make sure that there's good control. So right now that's the best option. I don't recommend that somebody sits around and waits for the next opioid drive. In fact, I don't even recommend that in our community. I give them today's option.
Right.
That's the best option. Certainly if you're in a community where you say, hey, there's nothing in a drivable distance for me, what do I do? Well, in that case, I do suppose that the mixing it with the unsavory substance, stick it in the garbage and throwing it away is probably, it's certainly a better option than leaving them unguarded in a medicine cabinet.
Right. Okay. So let me switch gears a little bit. I know a fair number of primary care doctors who, you know, feel a lot of frustration. They'll get a patient maybe transferring from another doctor or coming in from out of town, trying to establish care. They're already on long-term chronic opiates, and they feel a lot of frustration with kind of how to handle this. Do you have any interactions with primary care doctors around this, and is there anything being done to kind of address people who are on huge numbers of opiate pills and actually using them?
Yeah, so the primary care chronic pain issue is big and complicated, but I'll bring it back at least within our narrative to tell you what we're doing.
Yeah.
We realize that what we're doing is actually directly affecting primary care. So we have data, again, unpublished but nearing publication, clearly showing that for those people that go down the path of new persistent use, surgeons are the dominant prescriber for 3 months. And then almost immediately after the three-month mark, there's a major drop that just basically falls off the cliff and the primary care physician takes over. And so some of our new work is around transitions of care and thinking about tightening up that care, because I don't think we're going to get away from prescribing opioids for some cases, right? But when a person's heading down a bad path, why is it that we wait 3 months to get them back in to the person who knows them best and probably is going to take care of them to follow? How do we tighten that up? And certainly it's a challenge. It's hard to be a PCP today. It's hard to see 40 patients and then have this now challenging patient walk through your door unexpected. But, you know, we need to figure out care models to do this. And I'm not saying we have it figured out per se, but we certainly have thoughts and plans around at least tightening up that care and detecting a person who might be heading down a bad path and getting them back to their primary care physician sooner. In that same way, preoperatively, I'm sure when we started talking about opioids as it relates to surgical care, everybody closed their eyes and pictured the most challenging patient that they've cared for who's on lots of opioids and was in pain postoperatively. While that's not our primary focus today, I can tell you for sure we're doing work in this space in sort of in parallel in background. I think the what to do with the person not using opioids is novel. It offers a preventative opportunity to avoid new chronic use and make people safer in their communities. However, we certainly appreciate the fact that that we'll need to do work with the chronic opioid user. And we have work happening in that space. It's just probably a more complicated topic that's going to need a little bit more time.
Sure. Fair enough. And in terms of, you know, can you give a basic, again, I'm sure there's a long answer to this, but when you think about the downsides of chronic opioid use, you know, is there something that you, you know, what is the kind of 30,000 foot view? Why do we not want people on chronic opioids? Or why do people maybe not want to be on chronic opioids? What are the downsides?
Yeah, so I want to be clear. As a pain physician, I still have some patients I maintain on opioids, and I still think there are patients that do well chronically.
Okay.
I think it's limited. I think it's certainly not at the level at which we currently prescribe. And I still don't have any patients on really high doses who are doing well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of what the CDC's sort of dose limit recommendations were. I don't have anyone on more than 90 milligrams a day oral morphine who's doing well. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that is a point of frustration. It's certainly not the focus of Michigan Open. You know, this is me now talking as a chronic pain physician.
Sure.
But I'll say I do manage patients on chronic opioids. That said, we have data from a group. Jenna Gessling has done some really fabulous work in this space and has a K23 from NIDA, is doing really interesting work looking at some of the behavioral aspects associated with opioid use, the links between depression and opioid use, and really striking data to show some articles just published in Pain Medicine recently from Jenna showing that most of our patients coming in the pain clinic, right around half of them report an hour or less of pain relief from that opioid, mm-hmm. but still would sort of globally call it beneficial. And so I think we have to unpack it and understand that's a big part of what Jenna's work is doing, is trying to understand how people perceive benefit, how we help them maybe see that these haven't been helpful. Because I can tell you in the clinic, I spend a lot of time with patients sort of taking them through their history. Let's talk about your opioid use. Let's talk about how your pain is, your function is. And when you work people through this, there's a lot of times that you can bring a person out and say, are you really better?
Right.
Right. And many times they're not. But then the concern that I completely empathize with for patients is they're now scared. If I come off, I'm going to be a lot worse.
Right.
And we've been weaning people off opioids for years in our pain clinic. And what I can tell you is sometimes that requires replacement therapy with something like buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's just about weaning them down or off. And while people's pain may not be better, so in other words, this opioid-induced hyperalgesia, you take them off and the theory would be their pain would get better, that doesn't always happen. However, what does happen in a person you can get to wean off is this. Their pain may not be better, but they're more functional. They're more awake. Their mood's better. And you see it from their families in particular. The family member will sit there and say, thank you for giving me my mother back.
Yeah.
That's a very clear memory. Or the younger guy with two young kids who said, I feel like I'm a part of my kid's life again. I still have my pain, but it's certainly no worse. It's no better, but it's no worse. But I am now interacting with my family again. And those are the things that I think people don't, you know, we can't just make it about pain. You have to look at the global effects, and opioids definitely are associated with depression in both directions and don't necessarily always improve function. Right. And they can actually make you very, they can really, you know, decimate function. And I think it's an incredibly complicated, packed topic that merits of future research. I also think it's so complicated. It is the reason we didn't start there as a group, because we really felt like that's where most of the country's focus is right now, is what to do with folks. And there is some great research, not only in our institution, but at other institutions. There's groups, the University of Washington, who are doing great work around this.
Great. All right. Well, that's great. That's a nice overview of that. Let me ask you about anesthesiologists who are not pain physicians, and what role we play. So, you know, we're not almost ever prescribing opiates. And our main role, as you know, is in the operating room and in the recovery room, some of us in the ICU. But let's stick to just the general anesthesiologist who's in the operating room and the recovery room. What role, or what do we know about the role that plays? Should we be trying to reduce the amount of opiates we give in intraoperatively and in the recovery room? And what do we know about that?
So it's a great question. And it's one for which I think there's a lot of controversy in the community. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to unpack it because I'm going to look at it in sort of three different components. One is the anesthesiologist in the operating room and this idea of opioid-free anesthesia. So I don't think that there are some data suggesting the fact that patients who get fentanyl and remifentanil in the operating room use more opioids postoperatively and maybe have more pain. We don't really know what that means for long-term outcomes. We really, really don't know what that means for long-term outcomes. And I'm not ready yet to say that opioid-free anesthesia is the answer. I think it's also important to remember that your state of consciousness might matter. My colleague George Mashur would talk about how the patients who are under a general anesthetic who get ketamine, that effect of ketamine is different when you're under a GA versus when you're awake, mm-hmm. right? And so we really need to kind of maybe consider how we're giving and what it gives. That said, while I don't think that there's evidence to yet support opioid-free anesthesia as a requirement or a path forward to fix the opioid epidemic, I will caution to say that it's actually okay for anesthesiologists maybe to pause and just ask that question. We have a tendency, especially as we've kind of more tightly regulated how we manage our medications perioperatively, to just give that last 50 mics because it's easier than sort of wasting it or mm-hmm. monitoring it. And also, you know, to give very liberally with the idea that you're not changing that person's course. I think cautious, thoughtful use of opioids perioperatively is appropriate. I just gave a grand rounds to ophthalmology the other day, said, and their question to me was, does every single patient coming in for cataract surgery need 12 and a half or 25 mics of fentanyl?
Because that's what they all get.
My answer is no, right? And this is the problem. We have become maybe too routine, too protocolized. And while I'm spending a lot of my time asking surgeons to think more, I do think anesthesiologists should pause and think, and we can change our care. But the opioid-free anesthesia, I think, merits good research. And having groups out there, and there are groups out there sort of say, I've done 1,000 cases without opioids, and all my patients are doing better. That's tough, right? I mean, there's lots of things that go into perioperative care. There's also studies floating around that look at, the use of regional blocks and some of our multimodal techniques and long-term outcomes. And nothing's jumping off the page in terms of like this changing the rates of new dependence. However, I will say before we say the anesthesiologist doesn't matter, one important gap right now is you're right. We don't prescribe. And so in that person who we make a lot better after surgery, they have very little pain. They use very little opioids. They still go home with 60 pills.
Right.
Why? And one of the articles that recently came out that was published in JACS, the Journal of American College of Surgeons, by the Hill and Barth from Dartmouth showed that one of the best predictors of how much a person would use after they leave the hospital is how much they used in the day before they left the hospital. Mm. And I think that's really interesting, right? So as an anesthesiologist, what's your role? Well, if you're part of the acute pain service and you see a person hasn't used any opioids and they give them 70 pills to go home with, can you have just an informed conversation? It doesn't have to be aggressive. Just a, hey, by the way, did you know that for the last day, Mrs. Jones didn't use any pills or only used one pill.
Right.
And just get people to think a little bit about this and have that conversation. I guess as an anesthesiologist, what I would love to see, granted I'm a chronic pain physician and granted I primarily do clinical research today, right? So I'm not in the trenches doing this every day. I appreciate that and I know it's different. I would love to see anesthesiologists step up to the table and say, we're going to do transition of care medicine as it relates to opioids and pain care. We're going to provide the forum through which people can come in and get preoperative optimization. We don't know that weaning people off opioids before surgery makes them better or changes their outcomes. We know patients on higher doses or those just using opioids before surgery have worse outcomes. We know that for sure, right? But what we don't know is, can you reverse that? I can say this, though. Optimizing patients, even if they don't wean down, and setting expectations and making plans, I don't think anybody's going to have trouble saying that that's going to improve care.
Right.
Right. And more importantly, let's not just do preoperative optimization. Let's see people postoperatively. Let's manage people. And if we wanted to think about our role and how this relates to primary care, well, if we were able to tell primary care physicians, hey, by the way, we're going to promise that that person is not going to come back to you any worse than they came in. So postoperatively, if they came in on 50 oral morphine equivalents preoperatively, I'm not going to send them back to you until they're on 50 or less.
Right.
And I got to say, if I look at my academic career, part of the reason that I've been successful is because early on somebody told me I couldn't do something. It was very simple. I had someone from the FDA tell me I couldn't do something, and that just struck me wrong, and I went and I did it. And I hope that that listening today, there are people out there that are going to be bothered by what I'm about to say. But I think anesthesiologists won't take this opportunity. I think as a specialty, we will let this opportunity sail by us and someone else will do it. And we will have internists and psychiatrists managing acute pain. And while I think that internists and psychiatrists could add huge value in an integrated system, they don't understand acute pain the way an anesthesiologist understands acute pain. And there is an opportunity here that's right in front of us that is good for the healthcare system. It's good for society. And I would love to see anesthesiologists step up to the plate. But I don't think it'll happen. And I hope there's several people listening today that'll prove me wrong.
I hope so too. I think that's exactly right. It's always easy to keep doing what you're doing, but harder to step up and make a change. So thanks for saying that. So lastly, I want to ask, we think a lot about multimodal treatment for pain these days. And one thing that comes up a lot is that, there are other pain medicines, obviously, than just opioid pain medicine. So we've got, I think the two big ones, right, are the NSAID group and then Tylenol. We use a lot of Tylenol, and we tend to very rarely give, for example, Toradol postoperatively, with the exception of some specific cases, because surgeons don't want it. And so my question for you is that, does the evidence back that up, or should we be using more NSAIDs postoperatively?
I think we should definitely be using more NSAIDs postoperatively. There are meta-analyses that come out that show that short courses of NSAIDs don't have the adverse effects that everybody's worried about. And I think if we look at morbidity and we say, what's morbidity associated with overprescribing of opioids versus what's the morbidity of a short course of NSAIDs, it unambiguously favors the NSAID. Mm-hmm. And so there's certainly patients for whom we want to be careful, those patients that have, true peptic ulcer disease or really impaired, renal function or some other contraindication to an NSAID, which is a small portion of our population, right? It's a small portion of our population. Right. And we have greatly undervalued acetaminophen in nonsteroidals. And I think a challenge back to our surgeons, because we are in many ways in anesthesia in a service role and don't get to necessarily make that decision, is to just sort of say, we're going to reevaluate the true risk associated with nonsteroidals and apply a more logical framework to how we decide who does and doesn't get nonsteroidals. I certainly think nonsteroidals are going to be a critical piece of what we hope to do, which is actually eliminate opioids from some surgeries. Well, we're talking about reduction for cases, but I actually believe there are many surgeries out there today where if you go back 25 years ago, people never got them and did pretty well. Mm-hmm. And today, always get them. And I think if we really want to move the needle, we need to create expectation. And I talked to our local newspaper earlier today, sort of said, it's also incumbent upon the lay press to help us reframe the narrative and have people coming in understanding that there are some surgeries for which opioids shouldn't be expected.
Right.
And I think that other things like nonsteroidals and acetaminophen are critical. I think there's the gabapentin, the duloxetine, those are harder to really fully understand, right? And the data are more mixed. But boy, low hanging fruit with nonsteroidals and acetaminophen.
Right. Yeah. There was an interesting piece, I think, in the New York Times recently that was written by a woman who had been in Europe for some procedure, and I think it was a
hysterectomy.
It was a hysterectomy. Okay. Yeah. And didn't get prescribed any opiates when she went home, and she couldn't believe it, and thought this was going to be terrible, and ended up, of course, being fine. But the expectation, because she's American, was that she would get all these opiates.
Yeah, they gave her tea.
That's right.
That was what they recommended. They recommended that she pick her favorite tea.
That's
and
right.
We've done this. Our group went over to Europe and we asked questions. I think Americans should feel better to know that while they prescribe less in Europe, they also don't know how much people use after they leave the surgery.
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
And so no one really knows, right? It's just that It's just they don't prescribe as much, and I think their patients don't expect as much. And I do empathize with the surgeon who says, you know, people expect this, and I'm worried about satisfaction. But we published an article in JAMA last year showing that there was no association between the number of pills prescribed and satisfaction. And that's why I always say, if you want to improve satisfaction, consult a customer service organization. Here we have a great sandwich shop, Zingerman's, who and they offer great customer service training, and they've changed our customer service in the pain clinic. In a pain clinic where we wean people off opioids and don't inject unless we think it's appropriate, we have a 95% satisfaction rating. And it's really because satisfaction isn't about pills prescribed. It's about how you care for people and how you treat them.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Two other quick things that come to mind. I want to ask you about tramadol. I think we often think or are told that tramadol is a, you know, if Tylenol and maybe an NSAID aren't enough, that tramadol is safer than, let's say, oxycodone. Is that true? How do you think about tramadol?
So I think there are medications like oxycodone, which seem to be particularly bad players. However, all opioids have addiction potential. And in the UK, they have a tramadol epidemic, right? So they predominantly prescribe tramadol. I think there is something to be said about some of the metabolism variants that we see in people, which is probably comes down to where some of the pharmacogenetics might come in play. Mm-hmm. But you know, tramadol can lead to addiction, and there are people that get addicted to tramadol. There was an article on NPR about how Boko Haram are using tramadol in Africa to get people addicted and you know, can perpetuate terror. And so, you know, these are things that we don't think about because we sort of think about tramadol. I have many people say, I don't use opioids, I use tramadol.
Right. Right.
That's common. I hear that almost every week. And, you know, people are surprised when you say, well, actually, tramadol is a weak mu agonist, but it is still a mu agonist. And for somebody who is a rapid metabolizer, it might be a pretty good mu agonist, right? So it has that potential. Is it safer? I don't know that we have any data to say that yet. And I think it still requires that you're careful with how you prescribe and you're thoughtful for how you care with how you care for patients.
Great. And then my last question is, you know, if we've got a billion unused pills in this country, that's a billion unused, but it's also a billion pills that are getting made. If we're successful, if you and your group, and if it spreads, and we as a profession are successful in vastly reducing this number, that's a huge number of pills that won't need to be made. Are drug companies on board with this? Are they pushing back? Are they involved at all? How's that playing out?
I have thankfully been able to stay off of a radar yet. I don't know how long this is going to happen. There are some people who have been more involved in the CDC guidelines who have sort of, you know, been on the radar of some of these companies. I will say this for the medicines we use for acute pain, they're primarily generic. Mm-hmm. They're cheap. There's certainly profit to be made though from making these medications. And we haven't had any pushback yet. It may come, but it may not come from some of the big pharmaceutical companies that have been frequently named in lay press. Mm-hmm. I don't think I need to say them here. Everybody knows who they are.
Sure.
But it may be more through both the generic companies and the third party distributors who, yeah, I mean, certainly they profit from that. I mean, it wasn't very many years ago. I think it was back in 2012 that hydrocodone was the most commonly prescribed medication in the United States.
Right.
I mean, that's striking, right? More than antibiotics, more than anything. It was the most commonly prescribed medication in the U.S. And now it's still, I think, top five. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it's still in the top five. So yeah, I mean, I think there's potential financial implications and people are going to be concerned, but we move forward with a path of trying to make people healthier, doing it with patients in the middle, really trying to attend to their care and make sure we're still caring for patients. And you know, I know there's this concern about opioid hysteria and that it's not a real epidemic. Well, and that if, you know, there was an article in Politico just yesterday saying, well, even if we reduce today, mortality won't change today. It won't change today, but I hope you and I aren't talking 10 years from now and talking about 300 deaths per day.
Yeah.
And that's where we're heading. And so will prescribing changes affect mortality today? Probably not. But I have a long view here, and I want to know that in 10 years we're going to be in a better position. And I think we can make changes that are faster than that, but I do believe that we have a lot of work to do. It's just that the idea that prescribing changes won't change mortality, so we shouldn't do anything, Well, that's inherently flawed. There's no question. Increased prescribing led to increased mortality. The links are there, and it's happened. In the same way, while there might be a lag, we need to decrease.
Absolutely. Chad, thank you so much. Is there anything else that we didn't go over that you think we should cover before we
end? The only thing I'll say is I know there's a lot of hospitals out there that are forming the committee to make the materials to give to patients. Michigan Open has made patient materials specific to acute care. We are making some for primary care, but right now, if you're doing anything around surgery, dentistry, et cetera, we've actually made really engaging pamphlets, colorful pamphlets with pictures and done with a graphic designer. And one thing that's really important, if someone sends us a high resolution logo of their hospital, we will actually put this logo on the patient information and send it back at no cost for you to use in your hospital system. We want these to be used, and all the energy and information you're going to spend with that committee to make the material, use that time to figure out how to effectively disseminate the information. That would be a big win for us. We'd love feedback on it. We'd love to know if it works, and we'd love to know that you're using it. But right now we have major hospital systems in 9 states using it, and it's only been available for about a month and a half. So we've found that people enjoy it, and they appreciate it. And if you go to michigan-open.org, there's a contact us site where we can help make that happen.
That is fantastic and incredibly generous of you guys. So thanks for saying that. Check out the website, michigan-open.org, and check out those materials. Chad, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the show. It's been fantastic and inspirational, and I hope people follow your lead.
Thanks, Chad. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Bye.
All right. Well, that was fantastic. I hope people really got a lot out of hearing about Chad's work that he's doing there, and really check out the website. There are all kinds of materials, including those free available materials for your hospital if you want them, ways to get involved. So really check that out. And go to our website at acrac.com, where you can leave a comment on this or any of the other episodes. Let us know what you think about Chad's work. Are you interested in getting involved? Are you doing anything similar? And what do you think about the opioid crisis? We can all learn from what you have to say when you leave a comment on the website. That's accrac.com. I'm also interested to hear what you think about intraoperative opioid use. I tell my residents I hardly ever use fentanyl with induction. I prefer Esmolol. There's no reason to use fentanyl for induction. It's not painful the way surgery is painful. So I use Esmolol to blunt the sympathetic response, and then use fentanyl or Dilaudid if you need it for pain later. But what's your practice? We can all learn. I'm interested to hear what other people out there are doing. Are you trying to limit opioid use in the operating room? And if so, how are you doing it? All right. And remember, if you are a fan of the show, consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It helps other people find the show when they're looking for an anesthesia podcast to listen to. And of course, if you're interested in helping with the costs of making the show, you can become a patron of ACRAC by going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC. And you can sign up. Even just a dollar or two makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. All right, that is it for today. Thanks for listening. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Chad Brummett, I am Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.